Hey, folks, this is Risk, the show where people tell true stories they never thought they'd dare to share. I'm Kevin Allison, and every Thursday we release these special episodes where we look back at content from the earlier years of the podcast. This week, it's the best of Happy Stories number 2. We have two of the most beloved storytellers in the New York City scene on this one. In a little bit, we're going to hear from Julia Wiedemann, but first, a story from Larry Rosen, an instructor at The Moth. Larry first shared this one on the podcast in 2012, and here he is now with a story we call The Eye in Team.
At the age of 36, while living in Los Angeles, I was invited to join a men's a cappella singing group. It was the first time I'd ever been invited to join a men's anything. I'd never been one of the guys. I had no brothers, very few male cousins. My friends were all these misfit loner types, and I sucked at team sports. I was good at standing out. Often in some really good ways. I was often class president. I was a high scholastic achiever. I was often the lead in the school play. I had never had that experience of being part of an ensemble and just surrendering to that group energy. And this is something I had pined for. And so the invitation to join this group was really an answer to a prayer. I mean, it was guys and it was music. I mean, we would literally be harmonizing together, and these guys knew their harmony. I mean, the five who had started the group had all gone to Yale together. And so they took their music very seriously, which was a little bit intimidating. Also, the fact that they had decided to name this particular singing group the Upscales. And I thought, okay, I'm surrendering to a better class of ensemble. And I went for it. And I showed up at the first rehearsal early. And I listened intently, and I followed instructions, and I came home with a stack of music and practiced a lot at home, and I diligently showed up at every rehearsal, and we'd work and work and work. We'd take these sections of the music and practice them again and again and again. And the sounds that came out of these 12 guys were amazing. And I found out after a very short time that this was really tough for me. I had a really hard time fitting in. It was tough for me musically. First of all, volume. You had to sing loud enough to be heard, but not so loud that you'd be heard above everyone else. And so I found the only way I could do this was to sing such that I couldn't hear myself. And this used to freak me out. I used to feel literally like I was disappearing. And I would keep touching my chest and my neck to make sure I was still there, and also that I was still vibrating. I also had developed a vibrato. I'd grown up listening to the pop jazz singers that my parents used to listen to, the famous ones, and I had a particular fondness for Tony Bennett. And for years, I had practiced sort of getting his kind of shimmery vibrato. So after working on a lot of loud, bombastic kinds of songs, we started to work on some jazz ballads. And we were working on that old standard, How High the Moon. And I couldn't wait to inject my shimmery little vibrato. And I was quickly told, don't do that. It only works if we all sing in straight tones. So I had to pull back the vibrato. We were soon to begin to perform. And I found out that we were all going to be wearing uniforms. And the uniform was beige khaki pants and a blue Oxford shirt. I hated the way I looked in clothes like this. I never dressed this way. I thought I would cheat the outfit. So I got these khaki pants that were kind of big. They were baggy and they kind of ballooned over the shoes. And I thought it looked kind of cool. And I was quickly told, no, no, no. Tighter, crisper, shorter. And we started to perform. And the gigs were amazing. I mean, for an amateur group, they were really quite extraordinary. We headlined at the LA Zoo. We sang at Knott's Berry Farm, and on one unbelievable evening, we sang the national anthem in an LA Dodgers game. And through all of this, what I wanted more than anything else was to stand out. Occasionally, we would do these comedy numbers, and I'd be given a little bit to do. So we did that pop hit called Istanbul. You may know this. Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. And I would have this bit in the middle of the song where I would get to jump out in front of the line, and I would sing, "Take me back to Constantinople." And immediately, the two guys on either side of me would pull me back into the line, and everyone would point to me, and they would yell, saying, "No, you can't go back to Constantinople." And this kind of became a metaphor for my whole experience with the upscales. Istanbul! Including socially, which was also tough. To me, these guys had one discernible emotion, mirth. They were the happiest fucking people you ever saw, laughing and joking and laughing and joking. And look, I'd like to laugh and joke at least as much as the next person, but we spent a lot of time together. You would have thought there would have been one serious conversation. These guys would throw themselves birthday parties, and everyone would always go to everybody else's birthday party, and the parties all looked exactly alike. Games. We'd play Trivial Pursuit. We'd play charades. We'd go on scavenger hunts. And dutifully, I would go to every party, and I would trudge through every game. And I just kept thinking, can't we just talk? You see, my fantasy going into this was that because it was music that drew us together, that we would form these bonds of the heart, that we would bare our souls. And I used to get a little overdramatic. I'd think, how about if we all just sit around and cry? Let's all have a good cry together. And this was not the kind of thing that ever happened. Once, I was talking to a few of the guys about high school, and they were recounting different antics they had been involved in and different crazy things that had happened. And I just casually let it drop that I had spent the great part of my high school years in a state of near clinical depression, which I did kind of lightly and jokingly. But no one knew what to say. It kind of killed the conversation. I took a chance and I threw myself a birthday party. I had never done this before, and none of them was able to make it. I was not feeling sorry for myself. I have very dear friends. I was not alone. It's just that I felt like I was not clicking with these guys, and it was driving me crazy. And I would grouse about this constantly to my very dear friend Audrey, who herself was a loner. And one time after hearing me do this yet again, she looks at me and she says, "Is it really that important?" And I said, "Yes." I said, "You know, I've been wanting this ever since I was a kid. I really just want to taste this bond." And she said to me, "Maybe this is not the group for you." And she looks at me and she says, "It seems to me, if anything, you're becoming more independent." And she was right, truly. I had recently moved into my own apartment for the first time without roommates. And I was loving living alone. And I was working out a lot, and I was discovering the strength of my own body, and I was loving that. And I had started to teach and direct, and I found that I liked being a leader. And so after this conversation, I used to focus on this a great deal, what I called my inner leader. And I, at the same time, I found myself phasing myself out of the upscale social gatherings. And I thought about quitting the group entirely, but I made an even bigger move. I decided to move back to New York. I'd come to Los Angeles 10 years before from New York precisely because I couldn't hack it in New York. I didn't know what I wanted to do with my life. I was just kind of drifting. And New York is a horrible city to drift in. L.A. was so much easier. The climate was more friendly. The pace was easier. You could just sort of drive around in your car. The beach was right there. The mountains were right there. And I loved it. And now after 10 years with this new kind of renewed feeling of independence, I thought, no, I'm ready for this. So I told the upscales I was leaving, and the mood at my last rehearsal was mirthful. Congratulations. Good luck. Stay in touch. And then at the end of the rehearsal, they all got in their cars and they drove off. And I stood there thinking, okay. Now, I decided to take the train back to New York because I found something very romantic and sort of pioneer-like about taking the train. And I kept picturing myself being in this movie. You know, there's always that scene where you see the map and you kind of see the train making its way across the map. And I thought of myself not only as being in the train, I thought of myself as the train. It's like I'm chugging my way across the country. And so on moving day, I was driven to the train station by a very dear friend. We got there early. There was about a half hour to kill before leaving. And I stood there in the vestibule, and I just started watching the people, and I was conscious of the groups. that there were church groups and school groups and camp groups and families. And I was suddenly aware of how alone I felt. And it was this back and forth kind of feeling, these stabs of fear and a little bit of sadness, and then this exhilaration about this, felt like this new journey that I was going on by myself. And then the craziest thing happens. Now, outside Union Station, there was this ongoing crafts fair where people would sell the arts and crafts from their respective countries. And you would sometimes hear the music of their various lands. And I suddenly start to hear the strains of a Czech drinking song called I Luchka Luchka, which happened to be one of the staples of the upscale's repertoire. And I thought, this is freaking perfect. And suddenly I saw this whole thing as a movie. It's like the movie had been my life in L.A., and it had been one man's journey toward independence. And I saw this as the closing shot. And I'm looking around and I'm seeing the credits are starting to roll. And in front of me, there's all these groups. And in the back of me, there's the upscale's music. And in the middle, there's the hero looking determined and resolute, kind of nodding slowly. The camera's pulling away slowly toward the long shot. And the camera pulls away and pulls away. And then the camera stopped. And it starts moving in again toward the close-up because the music was getting louder. And I look in front of me, and I see a line of men walking toward me. And it was the upscales, who had come to the station to sing me off. And they stood on either side of me, and they put their arms around me, and we sang for these people in the train station. And it was time to board. They got on with me, and we sang for the train crew and the other arriving passengers. When it was time to go, they got off the train, and they stood outside. And I thought, I'm so close to these men and so different. And I thought, oh, fuck, I'm just going to be working this out for a long time. And this became the closing shot of my life in Los Angeles. The train starting to pull out of the station, the upscales outside waving and smiling, and me inside waving and sobbing.
It's 1997. I'm a senior at Mercersburg Academy, a small boarding school in southwestern Pennsylvania. And my braces are off, so I have perfect teeth. Perfect, beautiful teeth. So I know. One, in the long term, I'm on my way to being a famous Hollywood actress. Two, in the short term, this is the year that one of the many boys that I have a crush on will want to kiss me. Now, I was a little bit of a weirdo. Everybody knew everybody in my school. It was a very small school, so everyone knew everyone, and everyone knew that I was an actress. And so so I played up the, you know, just, I'm going to be famous. And and that was okay. And now that I didn't have braces and perfect teeth, I was like, well, one of these boys, I cast a wide net in the crush department. It's like, one of them is gonna like me back. Anyone was nice to me, I would be like, I can find something nice about them. And so enter Patrick. He was Southern and a wrestler, and cute, and he would laugh at my jokes, and I would laugh at his jokes, and he wasn't quite the boy that you would want to spend the rest of your life with, because he was kind of dumb, and you know, I mean, like, he was, but he was nice, so I, you know, so we were friends, so we were great friends, but I had also a big old crush on him, and one night, at a required meal, we're sitting there at the table while the plates are being taken away, and we're teasing each other like you do, you know? I'm like, oh, you're so weak, And he's like, no, I'm not. And I say, yes, you are. I am stronger. And he's like, I'll show you. And then we get dismissed from the table. And he grabs my arms and pulls them behind my back. And I'm like, no, no, no. Like you do when you're play fighting with the opposite sex in high school. And you desperately want to say yes, yes, yes. Just give me the opportunity to say yes, yes, yes. And it's no, no. And he starts walking forward. And I trip over my feet. And because there was a cold tile floor for me to fall onto with my face, I did. And a crowd of teachers and students form around me while I pick myself up. And people are like, oh, my God, what happened? And I see Patrick, and he's like, oh, my, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. If there's anything I can do, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry, I'm so sorry. He looks horrified, and I'm like, I'm fine. You know, besides the initial shock of falling on my face and the ever so slight taste of blood in my mouth, I'm fine. I'm fine. Like I touch everything, I'm fine. And I'm so thrilled that I'm fine. And the next 3 days over the Thanksgiving break, I convinced myself that I am fine, even though the pain behind my left front tooth is increasing and it's so intense. And also it looks as though someone has taken a pencil and shaded in my tooth a little bit more every day, but I'm fine, I'm fine, I'm fine, until Black Friday when we pause for lunch, the shopping, and I order a Reuben sandwich and I can't bite into it without bursting into tears, and I'm rushed to the dentist and I get an emergency root canal because the root had been severed from the fall, and they had to remove it through surgery and dental surgery, and they took it out, and then they plastered it back up, and now I had a dead tooth. And besides being very careful when I ate carrots and apples, and that it would just become a deader and deader, blacker tooth over time, like my life could go back to normal. Okay, so okay, and it looked, you know, at first it was like I could see it, but everyone was like, no, it's fine. I don't notice it. And so anyway, I go back to school with the dentist bill. I was to take this bill to Patrick. And Patrick's father refused to pay because he said that I had refused help after the initial incident. So Patrick was not responsible for any damages accrued henceforth, forthcoming in so much as blah, blah, blah. Of course, my parents don't take no for an answer, and then the letter writing battle begins. And the school gets involved, and this is before anybody has email, so it takes the rest of the year. And of course, I side with my parents, and because they say it's Patrick's fault. He should pay. I'm like, obviously, yeah, sure, you know, that's what they say. So I agree with them. And naturally, Patrick sides with his father. And so we can't be friends anymore. Fine. And I graduate, and years go by, and my mom occasionally says, you know, hey, Julia, do you ever think of getting back in touch with Patrick and seeing if you can get the money? And I say, no, 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 no. I hate Patrick because Patrick stole my perfect teeth. And I know it sounds over dramatic. I get it. Okay. But at this point in my life, all that I can think of is I just spent 3 years of my life suffering through braces and headgear, and not the normal kind of headgear that you have around your neck. I had the kind of headgear that goes over your head and makes you look like a horse. And I had to wear it during the day. The day. And oh, that's all I can think of. And now I can't be a famous Hollywood actress. Not with a big black front tooth. That's not the niche I want to be in. By no means. And you know, seriously, you know, and it was just getting darker and darker. And I thought so seriously. I was so worried about people noticing it. And I would look at pictures of myself and be like, there is the black tooth. There is the black tooth. There it is. And I thought, okay, fine. I won't be a Hollywood actress. I'll be a stage actress. That's what I'll do. You can't see it, you know, from so far away. That's what I'll do. But you still have to take headshots. So these are my headshots. Like a Mona Lisa smirk. You can just read the resentment. That's me selling myself, you know, like, hire this one. You know, she'll solve your crime. I would have relationships with men, and when I knew that they were getting serious, I would sit them down and say, I have to tell you something, as though I was about to admit to having an STD or having a child by another man, or having survived some horrible childhood abuse by a molesting uncle, and say, I have a dead tooth. And they'd look at me and say, where? And I'd be like, and this one, and say, I can't see it. And I'd be like, yes, you can. You're a liar if you can't see it. And it got darker and it got darker. And but I did eventually grow up and just chalked it up to childhood idiocy. And I didn't hate Patrick anymore. I just, whatever. It was everybody's fault. It was nobody's fault. It's just a tooth, whatever. And like my mother said, maybe one day I'd marry a dentist and he'd be able to cap it for free. So 10 years go by and I go to my high school reunion, class of 98. And there's an after party at the local bar in town off campus. And I squeeze through to get to the bar. And I'm looking for the bartender. It's crazy packed and I realize I'm standing next to Patrick. And he sees me and he says, well, hello, Julia Wiedemann. And I say, well, hello, Patrick. And he looks a little fatter, a little older, and a little like he follows the impulse to drink every day, but didn't we all in our late 20s? And we start chatting about, you know, how funny all the old alumni are, doing all the school cheers and how crowded it is and how good it is to see everybody. And he stops a moment and he says, I'm so sorry about what I did to you. And I know exactly what he's talking about, but I laugh it off. I say, oh, Patrick, psh, stop. That was years ago. Stop it. Forget it. And he says, I know. And I've thought about it ever since. I couldn't stand up to my father back then, but I have my own money now. I'd like to pay to fix your tooth. Please let me pay to fix your tooth. And I look at him, and I see my friend. And I realize I've wasted all these years hating him. And he was that boy with this horrified look on his face. I'm sorry if there's anything I can do. And I just hated him. And he'd spent all those same years feeling so guilty. And we'd ruined a friendship over a ruined tooth. A fucking tooth. So there we are, in the middle of southwestern Pennsylvania in a bar. Me, Patrick, and my dead tooth. Needless to say, I let him fix my tooth. Thank you.
Smile, though your heart is aching. Smile, even though it's breaking. When there are clouds in the sky, you'll get by if you smile through your fear and sorrow. Smile and maybe tomorrow you'll see the sun come shining through.
This is Risk. This is Nat King Cole behind me now. And we just heard from Julia Wiedemann, who you can find at juliawiedemann.com. And that's all for the best of happy stories number two. If you have a happy story, pitch us. Everything you need to know is at risk-show.com/submissions. Folks, today's the day. Take a risk.
That's the time you must keep on trying. Smile, what's the use of crying? You'll find that life is still worthwhile if you just smile.